Many persons are hampered in their efforts to become more self-aware and their efforts to reintegrate disowned elements of their personality. Many persons are hampered by the notion that there are such things as inherently evil thoughts or inherently evil emotions. And by evil thoughts or evil emotions, I mean thoughts and emotions which, simply by virtue of their presence, constitute evidence of one's immorality, sinfulness, or depravity. If I think this, I am no good. If I feel this, I am damned.
Since the concept of a child self may be new to you, let's pause to understand it. Each one of us was once a child, and perhaps we don't realize that we carry that child within us as an aspect of who we are. Sometimes we shift into the state of consciousness of the child we once were and respond to situations in our adult lives as if, for all practical purposes, we were still that child with his or her values, emotions, and ways of processing experience. The child self, left abandoned, typically proceeds to wreak havoc with our lives. This can make it impossible for us to have a happy love life or lead us to inappropriate behaviors at work or deny us adult forms of enjoyment.
Now you're about to destroy what's left of your career. It's pathetic.
Breathing in, I am calm.
Let's get the hell out of here while we can.
I ignore this mental formation. This is a mental formation.
Stop that shit.
This is just
a mental formation. I'm you, asshole.
Leave me alone.
You were a movie star, remember? Pretentious, but happy.
I wasn't happy.
Ignorant. But charming. Now, you're just a tiny, bitter cocksucker.
I was fucking miserable.
Yeah, but fake miserable. It's Hollywood miserable. What, are you trying to prove? That you're an artist? Well, you're not.
Fuck you!
So fuck you, you coward. We gross billions. What, are you ashamed of that? Billions!
We get billions of flashy shit every day. So what, does that make it good? I don't know if you noticed, but that was 1992.
You could jump right back into that suit if you wanted to. We're not dead.
Look at me. Look at this. Look. I look like a turkey with leukemia. I'm fucking disappearing. This is what's left. I'm the answer to a fucking Trivial Pursuit question.
You're an imposter here. Eventually, they're going to figure you out.
What part of this don't you get? You're dead. Please.
We are not dead.
Please, just stay dead.
We are not dead.
There's nothing we! There is no we! I'm not fucking you! I'm Regan fucking Thompson!
No, you're Birdman. Because without me, all that's left is you. A sad, selfish, mediocre actor grasping at the last vestiges of his career. What the hell did you do that for? I like that poster. It's always we, brother.
Fuck you! Shut the fuck up! Leave me alone! You're fucking so fucking annoying! Shut up! Hey, what's up?
Well, 1 hour till curtain.
Yeah, cool.
Why don't you try to rest a little bit?
Yeah, that's what I'm really gonna lay down.
Almost there, buddy. Last preview.
Okay, cool.
How you doing?
Good. Great.
Good.
About ourselves crucially affects almost every aspect of our experience. How we function at work, in love, the way we operate as parents, how successful we are at anything we try. Of all the judgments we pass, none is as important as the one we pass on ourselves. Self-esteem is the key to success or failure. It's also the key to understanding ourselves and other people. So many people suffer from feelings of being inadequate, feelings of insecurity. They doubt their own abilities, feel guilty about living up to some imagined standard, generally set by someone else. In the process of growing up, it's all too possible to become alienated from or never form a positive self-concept. What we want is a joyful vision of ourselves. The conviction that we're competent to deal with the challenges of life, that we trust our own minds, and that we deserve happiness. The strategies for the enhancement of self-esteem that I'll recommend have been thoroughly tested with thousands of people, and, on a more personal level, I've tested them on myself in my own pursuit of self-actualization. I've seen my own self-esteem get stronger or weaker, depending on how well I practice the principles. Self-esteem is always a matter of degree. I've never known anyone who entirely lacks some elements of positive self-esteem, and I've never known anyone who doesn't have the possibility of growing in positive self-esteem. So let's begin at the beginning. What is self-esteem? As I define it, it has two aspects: a feeling of personal competence, and a feeling of personal worth. Another way to say this is that self-esteem is the integration of self-confidence and self-respect. It is a conviction that one is competent to live and worthy of living. Self-esteem is an intimately personal experience. It resides in the core of our being. It is what I think and feel about myself, not what someone else thinks or feels. How we feel about ourselves reinforces what we expect the world to look like, which in turn reinforces how we feel about ourselves, and on in a cycle. There are a number of reasons why we may lack good self-esteem. We may have been inadequately nurtured as children. We may have absorbed negative messages about ourselves from others. We may be judging ourselves by too harsh, too uncompassionate a standard. Or it may be the case that we simply fluctuate in the range of average self-esteem, meaning sometimes we feel appropriate, competent, worthy of happiness, and sometimes not. But whatever level of self-esteem you may be feeling, now is the starting point from which you can rise. Raising your self-esteem is a process, one that can be very exciting and very rewarding.
Let's see action. Let's see people.
Every I'm recording two different ways, so you don't have to worry about recording on your end, unless it does it automatically.
I can, just for old time's sake.
Sure.
Just in case one of us gets hit with an asteroid.
Yeah.
It's a possibility.
It's true. So I always try to get my shows out as soon as they're done. Because wouldn't that suck? I mean, we're really in a cosmic shooting gallery here.
We totally are.
Wes, welcome back to School Sucks.
Great to be back. It's been over 2 years since we last talked about these topics.
Yeah, but we did, in the intermediate there, do a very, very important series that's going to fit in to this discussion of the seventh pillar of self-esteem, and that was the work we did on ACEs and trauma. I think that's going to factor heavily into these conversations.
That's right. Yeah, after we finished up on, I think it was the eighth episode in the series, we did a five-part series on your show. I did a four-part series on mine of trauma. And then you did a five-part series with myself and Matt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the self-esteem stuff. It's funny because I was thinking about doing the intro for this show, and I was going to say to you, Wes, it's important that we revisit a lot of this stuff because so much has changed in the world and in our lives, and we live in such, you know, dynamic times. So yes. I said, oh, I better go back and just, you know, revisit the original Six Pillars series. So in like the first 5 minutes of the first show, I say, Wes, the world is so dynamic and changing so fast. So I guess that's always the case. That's the way it is. We live
things
in a very
constantly changing,
ever-changing, even though it seems like the last year has been particularly exciting and interesting and disappointing in some ways. I do have to say that through and through, even though it wasn't the best year for politics or current events or people getting along or maybe even for me professionally, it was probably the best year of my life. And
that is awesome.
I wanted, you know, a year like that under my belt before we really concluded the self-esteem conversation on School Sucks podcast and Complete Liberty. And in our first pass through this topic, I know we talked a lot about the what of the six pillars, like what they are, and we explained each one. We talked about the why, you know, why these practices are really important in life. And this time around, I want to focus more on the how. You know, now that I feel like I've successfully integrated these practices into my life, like really, really over the last year, you know, it's one thing to learn these things. And I feel like I've learned so many things in my life and I've said, great. And now the only thing left to do is implement it. You know, like
exactly.
Now I have the knowledge. But in the last year, I feel like I really have, through, you know, a series of practices and daily habits. And that has brought, even while there are still, you know, significant challenges in life, it's brought a kind of stability and control that I really haven't enjoyed before. And I think what I realized is that, you know, under pressure, even after we did those shows, under pressure, I really needed to remember not to abandon these practices and these principles. And like I said, I think in maybe the last episode of that series, sometimes in a panic, it seems like I can forget everything I know. And really, really integrating these things and really, really bringing them into my life or anyone's life on a regular basis seems to correct that. You know, they become practices that actually alleviate a lot of the panics that I experienced before.
Yeah.
So that's been nice.
Yeah, it's a bit of a paradox, isn't it? Because the very things that would enable us to cope better, more with more resilience, more resourcefulness, more adaptiveness. You know, those are the words that Dan Siegel uses a lot about taking time in and so forth. They're not really the go-to strategies sometimes when we're feeling overwhelmed, when we're feeling stressed and not so resourceful. So
no, they are
again,
not.
Again, that's a great segue into the topic tonight, which is the seventh pillar.
Yes.
Which is the motivation to practice all of those six pillars.
Just so people know, I'm looking at my outline and it might be tonight and several nights to come, just so people are aware. Okay. But go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. We did the Adverse Childhood Experiences series just a little over a year ago. For some reason, I was thinking 2 years. But yeah, it was just over a year in 2015. So yeah, that was a nice addition to our discussion on the six pillars of self-esteem by Nathaniel Brandon. And he didn't talk a lot about trauma. He did talk about the nature of childhood experiences not being so enriching for most of us. and how that can lead to these various coping strategies and habits that don't really serve our interests so much as adults.
Right. And I think that was a real game changer for me in really getting some mind mastery. That series on trauma and pretty thorough examination of Bessel van der Kolk's book, The Body Keeps the Score, that really, really changed my frame of mind about, you know, what was going on for me internally, what was going on for other people close to me internally, which is often, you know, a tremendous source of one's own stress is what's happening around you, you know, and not understanding the behavior of others, whether they're people that you're worried about or people that you care about. And that can be, you know, very stressing and very traumatizing even in some cases. So having at least what I would say is a chapter in the owner's manual for the human mind and better understanding those emotional landscapes. And really, in this case, I guess, to be specific, the parts of self and how they work together or how they don't. That was, I think, a great follow-up. I mean, it's great to be able to look back. All these things are done over the span of years, but a new listener, you know, to either Complete Liberty or a new visitor to your website or a new listener to School Sucks podcast can find this package all ready to go. And I think that, you know, the exploration of Nathaniel Brandon's work and the exploration of the trauma stuff, that one follows the other very, very nicely. And I'm hoping through the conversations that we have on the seventh pillar of self-esteem, we can, you know, kind of wrap that up a little bit.
Yeah, I really liked the six pillars that we did. And I actually reposted that on my feed for the Complete Liberty podcast because I thought it was so useful. And I had some additional audios by Brandon to throw into the mix as well. I think the more we can get these ideas out there, the better for everybody, because we didn't really grow up in a culture in which we can feel really comfortable and invited or welcome to take these emotional tune-ups. You know, we take our car in to get the oil change and so forth, but do we take our minds somewhere to help ourselves? I guess sometimes we talk with friends, sometimes we talk with family members and various other people that are close to us, but a lot of the times they don't really provide the kind of analysis and understanding that Brandon has provided here. And I think that's why we focused on those different pillars, because they are really comprehensive in terms of how our minds are interacting with ourselves and relating to other people and how we can optimize that.
Yeah. And I hope somebody in this audience or many people in this audience, I'm surprised we didn't think of this before, but I hope many people will be encouraged to start something like a discussion group where they can be talking about these things, because we know there is an interest. And I guess, if you had read Brandon's work on self-esteem in, say, like 1990, I mean, there you were by yourself knowing that. Today, you have a much better chance of being able to do that tune-up you described with other people. And, you know, I know we got a lot of positive feedback about that series, but I hope people will continue to explore those things on their own and with each other, even if, you know, we're not talking about next door neighbors. That's so easy to do today.
Yeah. And I think one of the aspects of it that Brandon actually talks about in his books is that we need to have this willingness to stand alone or to be alone sometimes, given the cultural status quo. So it takes a bit of courage and a bit of resilience, I guess, and determination to go into the psyche like this, which most people tend not to do, unfortunately. And that leads us down a path that may be different or divergent from other people.
Absolutely. So we talked in 2014 about the six pillars of self-esteem in detail, and we did two add-ons to those discussions. One was called Nurturing a Child's Self-Esteem, and then one focused on self-esteem in the schools. And what we're adding to that series now is this idea, what he concludes his book, Brandon's book, The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem, the concluding chapter is called The Seventh Pillar of Self-Esteem. And how would you explain that to the people in the audience?
Well, apparently it actually doesn't exist, Brett. That funny story. I think I related this to you when I went to Nathaniel's memorial service a little over a year ago. And that was in 2015 that he died. Just a few months before, I think it was Rosenberg who died after he did. In any event, I met his ex-wife Devers, who I think he had still maintained a friendship with for like a dozen years after their divorce. And they, during the time that they were married, they wrote a couple books together. And I believe they were together when he wrote The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. They published that in 94. Mm-hmm. So this was, you know, a few months after Nathaniel had died and many years after they had gotten divorced. And I really wanted to know sort of Devers' take on this seventh pillar. So I asked her about it and she just responded immediately that there wasn't a seventh pillar. She shook her head kind of like in disbelief or something. Mm. And it took me for a little bit of a loop because I wasn't expecting that kind of response. In any event, she apparently had forgotten that Brennan had written that part in the book as a concluding sort of chapter. It's only like 3 pages long, but I think it is symbolic of the nature of this process that it's almost like a meta pillar, right? The motivation to practice all six pillars requires this love of life, as he says, love of self and love of life and wanting to optimize your life and really reconcile a lot of things that don't get reconciled if we don't focus on it.
So right. Yeah.
The seventh pillar actually exists. It's just a little bit in the background because it's a meta pillar of sorts.
A potential to remedy that problem that I described a few minutes ago of, you know, going into a panic, knowing this information. And, you know, you gave me a nice media list a couple weeks ago of some cool stuff that you thought was worth listening to. And one of the shows that you shared with me was an entrepreneur, a great guy named Derek Sivers and his conversation on Tim Ferriss's show. In one of the discussions, they're both worth checking out, and I'll link them in the show notes. He has this line, and Tim Ferriss actually repeats it at the beginning of the show, and then you repeated it to me, that if information was all that it took, we'd all be billionaires with six-pack abs, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like you can learn these things, and all six of these practices make sense. They're things that people can very, very easily get excited about, you know, incorporating into their lives. But that doesn't mean that it's just knowing these things doesn't bring the change. There has to be that dedication to self and the motivation that comes with it. And, you know, I found that there were times in my life that I knew these things, but I just didn't have that extra piece and it didn't work. That's a source of frustration for smart people when we say to ourselves, I know how to do better. It's like an extra jab when things really go wrong. You know what I mean? Like I knew the right thing to do there, but I didn't do it. And I think an expansion of this idea, this simple 3-page idea at the end of this book will really be helpful, I hope, to many people in the audience who were able to get some value out of the first discussion we had.
Yeah, you can keep coming back to this well within the psyche to figure things out and to give yourself empathy and even compassion for various moments of suffering. Mm. You know, we all suffer setbacks and losses, and these can be very, very heart-wrenching at times. So it's important to go back to self and to realize that these practices are something you can do for a lifetime, not just once and you're done, right?
Right, right.
And of course, the theoretical overview seems really commonsensical. Like, who could really disagree with the things he's saying in here? But the integration process with the subconscious mind through the sentence completion exercises, I think, is probably the most beneficial aspect of it. And, you know, I actually covered this one. I did a show on the seventh pillar and the basic nature of self-esteem in the fall of 2014 after we had finished the six pillar series. We had gone on different routes, I guess. I ended up moving and you ended up moving in New Hampshire. And now I'm actually in San Diego. So funny we're doing a show about it now. But it'll be nice to reflect on that one as you go through this one as well, the series that we're doing on this pillar, because it is so important. And again, hardly anybody is focusing on this stuff. That's the real sad thing.
Yeah. And I think that once you know these things, he says in the book, towards the end of the book, that these practices are never automatic, right? Now, I think I might, in the future of this discussion, I might argue with that a little bit, but just being mindful that these practices always represent achievement in life. There's so many reasons why, but most of us really weren't wired to do these things, You know, so exactly. So being able to recognize and appreciate and be grateful for when the six practices actually get practiced is really important. But I also think setting up a lifestyle and setting up routines and developing habits that lead to them being practiced, and this is going to be a big portion of our discussion, is really, really important as well. You know, the thing that I like about habit is automatic decision making. You know, mm-hmm. It's easy to make bad choices when there's no plan or no routine. And, you know, not everybody is like this. And in fact, now I'm remembering Derek Sivers said in that conversation, I don't have any routines. I don't like that. Well, I need them, you know, and I really, that's great that he can get by without them. But I've really, really benefited from, you know, developing habits and incorporating the six pillars into those habits, right? Because they get practiced every day. And then there's the extra benefit of being able to appreciate that, you know, since they are really never totally automatic. I wasn't wired to do these things. That does always represent an achievement. And that's something that, you know, should be focused on and appreciated.
Yeah, grateful for. And I think if we basically fleshed it out with Derek about his non-habitual way of being, I think he's probably automatized some behavior patterns.
Sure.
He doesn't want to give credit to or something. It wants to be, you know, spontaneous about various things. But we wonder about this automaticity thing, because all this stuff of our lives and the things that we're talking about here is coming out of our brains. And the mind is what the brain does. And the things that we're conscious of and the things that we're unconscious of are all manifestations of the brain. So I guess when we talk about something being automatized, we're not necessarily having to devote or have so much conscious awareness or deliberative focus on something. It's just comes sort of second nature or automatically for us.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just part of the integration process. And as we try to integrate these six pillars, you know, it's going to require some conscious focus, some attunement, if you will, or awareness that we don't normally bring to these things. And then that relates to the emotional stuff that may come up as one does focus on things that have been maybe brushed aside or suppressed or denied or dissociated from, you know?
Yeah, so that become pressures against these practices a lot of the time.
There are hurdles to practicing the seventh pillar.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to think about it. Well, because it has been a couple of years, and because certainly there are people who are new, I thought it would be worth taking a few minutes to just review what the six pillars of self-esteem, those six practices, actually are.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the first one especially. And he wrote a whole book about this called The Art of Living Consciously. But yeah, the practice of living consciously, of shifting our awareness to things that are important and salient to focus on in our lives. So he's got a whole list of the differences between living consciously and living unconsciously. That's a really central pillar, because it enables all the different facets that we talk about. Like, we need to be conscious of these things if we're ever going to focus on them. So that leads to the practice of self-acceptance, of embracing reality for what it is, our inner reality and the outer reality. Not necessarily agreeing with or liking different aspects of ourselves, but nonetheless being on our own side and accepting the reality of the situation. You know, he has a phrase where he says, you know, we can't leave a place that we've never been, or we can't leave a place that we're reluctant to go to anymore, you know, to really heal and grow from. So that's the reason why self-acceptance is such a key pillar, is that we're not in an oppositional relationship with the reality of ourselves.
Yeah, and I think those first two relate together in a really important way that actually connects to the other conversation about, you know, the body keeps the score and the parts of self that need to be integrated, ultimately. Mm-hmm. A big part of self-acceptance is not disowning certain aspects of ourselves. There's things in us that we, oh, God, come on, we don't want to look at, you know? I mean,
yeah, the inner critic sort of comes to the fore there, right?
Yeah, it manifests in strange ways. Like, I'll just remember some horrifyingly awkward interaction that I had with somebody in college, and I'll cringe, and I'll almost start singing out loud to get that memory out of my head, you know, sometimes.
Go away, Patrick, like, go away.
Yeah, that was me. I said that out loud, you know, those kinds of situations, and not disowning those aspects of ourself. But part of that relates back to living consciously. You know, we do have abandoned selves or child selves that are carried within us as a really important aspect of who we are.
Since the concept of a child self may be new to you, let's pause to understand it. Each one of us was once a child, and perhaps we don't realize that we carry that child within us as an aspect of who we are. Sometimes we shift into the state of consciousness of the child we once were and respond to situations in our adult lives as if, for all practical purposes, we were still that child with his or her values, emotions, and ways of processing experience. Sometimes this can be desirable, for instance, when we experience the child's spontaneity and playfulness. Sometimes it's undesirable, when we reactivate the child's insecurities and dependency. We can learn to recognize that child, to listen attentively to what that child needs, even if it's painful. We allow the child self to be integrated into our adult self when and as we do this, but if instead we disown the child out of fear, pain, or embarrassment, making ourselves unconscious of his or her existence and needs, self-esteem worsens. Then the child self, left abandoned, typically proceeds to wreak havoc with our lives. This can make it impossible for us to have a happy love life, or lead us to inappropriate behaviors at work, or deny us adult forms of enjoyment.
The awareness of how those other selves, those less resourceful types of selves, referencing, you know, the Vander Kolk's work again and The Body Keeps the Score, realizing how those parts get activated is really essential in developing self-knowledge and understanding who we are. And then once you do that work, which is very much living consciously, not casting those parts aside is a very important part of the second pillar, which is self-acceptance.
Yeah, doing that self-acceptance work with the parts that we don't like or the parts that are embarrassing or that we have shame and guilt involved in, you know, to have a compassionate embrace for those parts is part of the healing process. It's kind of an inescapable part of this process of coming to terms with the whole part of who you are, like all the different facets of who you are integrated into one person. That's how we become more integrated rather than fractured, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that he wrote, I don't have the exact quote. It was in another book. I think he does this guided imagery book called Experience High Self-Esteem. It's about an hour long, and it's almost like a guided meditation, similar to the stuff Daniel Siegel does. And then there's another one called How to Raise Your Self-Esteem, which is a very short book. And he talks about how those undesirable things that we're willing to confront become like rungs on a ladder that lead to, you know, higher self-regard, which is, I think, a nice visualization for that.
Yeah, yeah. Integrating these fractured parts, giving them the compassion that they need in order to feel safe. I mean, if we can look at it from an internal family systems therapy point of view, you know, these are disowned parts, if you will, or protector parts, or just vulnerable parts that don't want to integrate because of these feelings that we have towards them. And so if we can be in alignment with ourselves and accept those dissonant parts, then it's much more likely that they're going to become integrated. They're not going to be as triggering for us, and we're not going to spend a lot of time trying to keep them at bay or keep them out of conscious awareness.
And we touched on this at least a couple of times in the first series, but self-esteem, the term, got a bad rep when it was basically summed up as unconditional self-acceptance, and really that was the only aspect of having self-esteem, just accepting what is. And that was a very, you know, new agey treatment of this subject. And, you know, whenever people say, I mean, I get people say, oh, self-esteem, but I think they're picturing something that is not as process-driven as what Brandon has laid out. They're picturing something that is just kind of like surrender, or, you know, oneness with what is, or some other kind of hokey concept. But this is just like, you know, this is just one aspect of a larger integrated process.
Yeah. Who is the psychologist or therapist that's been interviewed a few times? I think Tom Woods actually interviewed him as well about self-esteem. as not being a helpful construct.
Yeah, there's an episode of the Tom Woods Show that would probably be worth digging into before we everything is wrapped up here. I think it's called Squashing the Self-Esteem Scam Like a Bug.
Yeah. So this was Michael Edelstein, clinical psychologist who lectures throughout the United States and around the world, runs an in-person Skype and telephone therapy practice in San Francisco and Mill Valley, California. And I think he has something called the 3-minute therapy. There's a bit of a straw man that he's doing with the concept of self-esteem. He's conflating it with the sort of mainstream notion, not with Brandon's. And he criticizes Brandon's take on self-esteem, but not in a way that I think Brandon would recognize as valid, at least the things that Brandon focused on in terms of self-esteem. It's almost like the straw man is having this inordinate focus on yourself, and your self-worth and who you are depends, it's always hanging in the balance regarding your actions. It's almost like walking a tightrope. It seems like how he's portraying it. Whereas he's taking the view that we need to just have this acceptance of our self-worth and realize that we're fallible beings and not have our self-esteem dependent upon our actions.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess you could approach the six pillars with kind of a nervous orientation, but this is one part of a complete effort to better integrate the self. This obviously isn't a panacea to whatever kinds of emotional troubles you would go through. I could see somebody encountering the six pillars and having a very stressed out attitude about trying to say, well, these are the things that I have to practice if I want to be a good person. But I don't buy into that argument either, because I think once somebody finds this, they know enough about themselves to want to do better, to want to feel better. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't have that orientation towards being very nervous about, can I do this or can I not do this? And if I don't do this, I'm a failure. Nothing like that ever came through to me in reading any of Brandon's work on the subject.
Yeah, it might have been his experiences with the early objectivist community, where there was a lot of moralistic judgment.
Yeah.
I think when Brandon was hanging out with Ayn Rand, there was a lot of moralistic judgment, and that he kind of like combined with the self-esteem work that he did later on, apparently.
Sure. The critic, you mean?
Yeah, Edelstein.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think Edelstein, I don't think he would disagree with the idea that we need to have self-confidence and self-respect. Mm-mm. You know, I mean, is there any instance in which those things are not preferable or not useful for ourselves?
No, or just to feel like, what are Brandon's phrase, appropriate to life and to the requirements of life. I mean, if you are any kind of therapist, isn't that a footing that you're trying to help people develop? Mm-hmm. You know, having confidence in your own ability to think, having confidence in your ability to cope, that's the job of a therapist. So if he's doing therapy, which he is, I would think that he would agree with a lot of what Brandon's goals are for his work on self-esteem.
I think so as well. And Brandon actually has a section in the Six Pillars book about psychotherapy and relating to clients. And it's really about having this unrelenting respect and, in a sense, unrelenting empathy that most of us have never gotten. So it's kind of an unusual experience. But this belief that you can overcome these obstacles in your mind, these emotional difficulties that you've been struggling with, it's not something that is going to be with you forever if you focus on it and work through it. It's actually achievable.
Right. Absolutely.
So, I think that the criticisms of self-esteem are found wanting in many respects, especially if you look at how Brandon fleshes it out in terms of the six pillars. And so we move from self-acceptance into the practice of self-responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anyone would disagree that we need to be self-responsible, response-able, taking full accountability for our actions, our beliefs, our thoughts, our feelings, everything that is about us, we are able to respond to in a healthy way, rather than denial of responsibility, which disempowers us and it makes it seem like we don't have any choices anymore.
I think we live in a time where this is becoming a lot more prevalent in a lot of the political movements that we've seen. People looking for devils and people looking for saviors. There's a lot of abdication of personal responsibility.
Yeah, exactly. And that's terribly unfortunate, because freedom and self-responsibility go hand in hand. So the less responsibility we assume for ourselves, the less freedom we typically see ourselves as having or mm-hmm. are granted by those who presume to have power over us or rule us in the realm of politics.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then from self-responsibility, we get into the practice of self-assertiveness, which is, as Brandon would say, saying yes when we want to say yes and no when we want to say no. So really speaking in an authentic way and not sitting on needs. And this is a tough one when we live in a culture in which needs can be sacrificed right and left, and we have to obey, you know, seemingly have to obey and conform and comply and submit to systems of domination, lest we get in trouble or we get punished or we lose privileges or something.
Yeah. I said to myself, kind of tongue in cheek, when I was going through my notes, I said, self-assertiveness, this is really, I think, the one that liberty-minded people are best at of the six, right?
Uh-huh.
Not really terribly concerned with how others might respond, you know, if we're acting on the belief that we're being authentic. It's kind of a suit of armor, that authenticity or that allegiance to principles. Kevin Geary actually just shared a video earlier tonight on the website, and it's this young boy. He's an eighth grader, and he's speaking out about all of these social justice issues. And it doesn't really seem like, I mean, he's an eighth grader, so I could, you know, give him a little bit of a pass, but it doesn't really seem like he's got a really strong grasp on the depth of a lot of these issues that have to deal with race or class or gender. And what's coming across, and a couple of people actually commented on this in the thread, is that it seems like he's just seeking approval. And that's unfortunate, because my first read of this video was like, oh, well, here's somebody who really believes he's being courageous and even rebellious. And those are really good instincts for a young person, as long as it doesn't lead to, you know, dangerous or destructive behavior. I think that's great. But then to reread it as like, oh, maybe this is somebody who's just seeking approval. That's, you know, much more the par for the course when we're going through the schooling process. The rebelliousness is more covert from my experience anyway. So
it can be difficult to really speak our minds in a way that is, you know, not politically corrected by the cultural norms, by what society or other people typically want to hear. This is why it's important for parents to encourage children to speak their authentic voices, so that they don't end up sitting on their needs for choice and autonomy and self-expression and, you know, self-respect, basically.
Yeah. You know, when I was a teacher, so many of the behaviors that I had to kind of intervene in because it was my job, like breaking of the rules, no one ever said to me, like, I said, did you do this? They'd always say, no, I didn't do this. No one ever said, yeah, I did, and here's why, you know? And I think, like, so many of those behaviors, like, their right to want to assert themselves and even do what's called acting out or rebelling in those kind of environments, it's natural and it's healthy, especially for somebody, you know, entering adolescence or going through adolescence. I mean, there are like biological cues to behave that way at that age. Yeah. But no one, it was so unfortunate that no one would ever like step up and take the credit for it. Yeah, I did. and here's what I was thinking. But that's exactly how I behaved at that age. You know, very meek when it came. Like, I would try to see what I could get away with. But when I was actually confronted about what I did, if I get caught, I would be very meek, you know, and apologetic and not, you know, try to stick up for myself.
Yeah. And that's indicative of a culture that doesn't really practice this pillar so much.
Right. Yeah.
There can be a lot of argumentation, there can be a lot of conflict, but in terms of really digging deep into the psyche and speaking from that, you know, vulnerable place, you know, that vulnerability is something that we express early on, and then sometimes we get abused or neglected and overwhelmed and traumatized, and then we just kind of withdraw and get the defenses up. Mm-hmm. So when we're in that defensive posture, it's really hard to assert ourselves in this respectful and yet really authentic way.
Yeah. I mean, like when I give this example of somebody saying, yeah, I did that and here's why, that's obviously not optimal, but it would be better than, you know, total withdrawal. Mm-hmm. Because this is something that, especially for young people, when they need to be practicing self-assertiveness, it's really stamped out of them you know, through the culture, through parenting, through schooling. And that's really, really unfortunate because it makes the final two pillars so much more difficult.
Yeah. The practice of living purposefully, of creatively expressing what's alive in you and what you really want to achieve and following through on goals and just, you know, exchanging values with other people, creating values, creating wealth. I mean, all these things are living purposefully, having meaning in your life.
Right.
And then, of course, practice of personal integrity, which is being consistent with what one values. And the more one knows about these values, the greater the challenge and the opportunity to stay aligned with them, right? Because there's always a part of our mind that's observing whether or not we've been in alignment. And then if we haven't, how do we come back to self and practice that self-acceptance and, you know, admit to our fallibility and really correct ourselves, self-correct, rather than this tendency of the human mind to get into the defensive posture once again and pretend as if the integrity hasn't been breached.
Yeah. This idea, simply put, is that words and behaviors need to match. It's interesting that this is the final of the six because it really does seem like the most difficult one to practice consistently, you know? Or the one where the stakes are the highest, maybe.
Yeah, what one professes and what one does, what one believes, and how one interacts with those in the world based on those beliefs. And of course, this world we live in, this culture of humanity, is filled with all kinds of hypocrisy.
Oh, yeah.
And children notice this pretty readily, you know? So they almost get conditioned out of noticing it and just going along with the games of make-believe. You know, it's funny, you mentioned Duncan Trussell, I think, in the memory series you did.
Oh, yeah.
About how eccentric he can be and yet interesting and enlightened in some respects as well about mm-hmm. these issues of love and fulfillment and really being mindful. But he likes to talk about these games of make-believe. You know, some people pretend to be a politician. You know, some people pretend to be president or Supreme Court justices.
Right.
Or, you know, priests and all these different things that we have that are not authentic, that are just roles that people are playing that don't align with these objective values that we can distill about what is actually going to bring human flourishing. It's not systems filled with BS and that sacrifice human needs, especially the nature of individual rights, you know, and individual choice and freedom and respect. You know, a lot of these domination systems every day act contrary to integrity. Coming to terms with that is a difficult thing, and it seems like most people don't. You know, they don't really want to touch that because that opens up a whole can of worms that could be really discomforting in their social relationships.
I don't know. It seems like
jobs.
Yeah, I would say that a lot of people want to touch it when it comes to other people. They want to have their hands all over it in recognizing the lack of integrity in others, especially their enemies, mm-hmm. you know, that incongruence between words and deeds.
Yeah, so like on talk radio, the conservatives on AM radio will do this against all the liberals out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you switch over to NPR on FM and you get supposedly a more fair and balanced perspective, but the liberal leanings are definitely shining through most of the time and not really focusing on their own issues so much. But there's not, between both of those camps, there's not a look at the general atmosphere of these systems of non-integrity.
Oh, yeah. There's even been like squash sayings that have been invented for when young people point this out, like do as I say, not as I do.
Huh.
That saying came to be because I think the juniors of society recognize that incongruence in the seniors.
Yeah.
Not a new problem.
So the question that comes to mind is why can't you do it too? Is it that I only have to do it and you just talk about it?
Yeah. It's exactly. I don't know. I mean, but it is almost like, well, I mean, I can sympathize with parents, I think, in that case a little bit. Like, I'm a lost cause, but there's still hope for you, Junior. So just
I'm throwing you a life preserver by telling you how you should behave.
Stand on my shoulders and use me as a cautionary tale, you know, that kind of
exactly.
a thing. Yeah.
Lesson learned.
Right. So those are the six pillars. And the seventh pillar, you talked about as the mm-hmm. ultimate activation of psychological curiosity and dedication, right?
Yeah, and this true self-motivation to practice all the self-esteem pillars.
And you said that this was like a really, really important part. If you want to pursue self-directed learning, this is something that really, really needs to be integrated into that process, right?
Yeah, as a self-driven learner or self-directed learner, this mm-hmm. is part of that curricula,
right.
You know, this inner world, the psychological world, you know, there's the philosophical and the psychological to roughly sketch out these things that are common to all of us. Like all of us need to be philosophers and need to be psychologists, at least of ourselves and the world. So how do we make sense of the world that we're in? We're on this planet spinning through a cosmos. It's in a galaxy. And, you know, I don't know if you listened or watched some of that, that Juno probe that they sent to Jupiter.
But yes, I've heard a little bit about this.
That's just within our solar system.
Yeah.
Jupiter is an enormous planet, and we're going to glean more information about it. Unfortunately, they spent, I think, about $1 billion taxpayer dollars to get that thing to be in orbit around Jupiter. But they definitely hit the mark in that long-distance journey. But yeah, where are we, and what do we do as a consequence? And this process of understanding ourselves, of developing self-knowledge and deeper integration within ourselves of all those different parts from the past that might have been fractured as a result of traumatizing experiences, overwhelming experiences and neglectful experiences, abusive situations, all those kinds of things, all the power over systems that we were subjected to since we were little, you know, of course, including the schooling system that is all about power over others and telling people what to learn and when to learn it. If we break free of all that, then we set a course for developing this process of taking time in for ourselves and learning more and more about ourselves, becoming more intimate with ourselves so that we can relate that sort of intimate connection with others. And that makes life so much more meaningful because we're not just skipping on the surface anymore. We're actually going deep within ourselves. And that's why I see it as a vital subset of the self-directed learning process.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a cyclical process as well. I've been spending a lot of time trying to come up with this interactive graphic that I want to put on the School Sucks website. And it's like a roadmap to self-education. And so maybe people in their head could picture something like the Game of Life board game, some frame of reference for what I'm trying to create here. And it's like, start, you realized school sucks, right? But then what do you do? Like, where do you go from there? And I think that if you really want to be efficient in teaching yourself towards a purpose, towards, you know, an ultimate vision for your life, or even towards smaller goals, self-knowledge is really the first stop. You have to know what you want, and why you want it. But as I was trying to map all this out, I'm saying, well, how much self-knowledge do you need to get started? Because how many people would just get stuck? You know, I think I would. If somebody presented this to me when I was 17 years old, or even when I was in college, and said, all right, first you have to learn everything about yourself, and then you'll be ready to teach yourself, I would have said, no thanks. That sounds terrifying.
Overwhelming, so, and maybe a little bit boring or something.
Right. So this exploration of Brandon's work on self-esteem, the six pillars of self-esteem, I think is a reasonable amount to bring into your consciousness, to gain some self-knowledge. And even going through a book like The Art of Self-Discovery is not too much to bite off at once. And then I think as learning is cyclical in all respects, you know, you might take a first pass through something. I find myself doing this a lot. You know, I'll try to review what I know, solidify what I've learned, capture the important essences of that thing. Maybe I'll go off and do something else. And then I'll take a second pass through that information again to really try to make it concrete. I think this pursuit of self-knowledge, learning about oneself, has to work in a similar way. So, you know, I was trying to like design this infographic, and it's like, listen to the Six Pillars of Self-Esteem podcast series. Listen to Adverse Childhood Experiences and Resilience podcast series. And I'm like, whoa, I just lost a bunch of people. You know, that's too much.
Yeah, that one is a tough one because lifting the lid on Adverse Childhood Experiences is a major deal.
Yeah, yeah. So I think like letting this sink in, and you know, as we're talking about self-teaching, for most of my life, I really lacked mindfulness about what I was learning and why, because, you know, 15,000 hours of that, at least, it was a very passive process. I was learning things to basically avoid being in trouble, and which is obviously not really learning things. You know, I was trying to capture things that I could regurgitate on a test to stay out of trouble. And even when I was in college and I started to realize that I had some aptitude, there still wasn't a lot of mindfulness. You know, I wasn't answering the why questions for me. I did stumble upon answers, you know, like, oh, I really like history. Oh, I think I really like standing in front of a classroom. And I think maybe I could combine those things into a, you know, a vocation that I would really be excited about. But I was 21 years old by the time I realized that. So that whole rant was me agreeing with you that this is a vital subset of being a self-directed learner, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the idea of a graphic and maybe putting that self-knowledge task or set of tasks into one's backpack as one goes along the journey. So it's the first stop, but it's also something you can reach in and replenish yourself with as you go along on these other journeys. So it's almost like we take this philosophical insight and psychological awareness with us as we go and do anything in life. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to recognize that school does suck in many ways, but then also realize that learning is awesome.
Yeah.
And learning about yourself is really profound. And learning about another person's self is really profound. And that's the nature of relationships, you know? And as we get into this realm of self-learning, then we can really connect in ways that we might otherwise not have connected. So given that this is not a dress rehearsal, as a friend of mine in the freedom movement used to say, it's important to actually look at this most valuable aspect of self-directed learning as something that we take with us as we go along and learn about anything else.